Welcome to the Elite Broker Podcast with your host, James Mitchell. Hello and welcome to Elite Broker. I'm your host, James Mitchell, editor of The Advisor, and we're joined once again by Annie Kane, our regular co-host. How are you doing, Annie?
Good, thanks, James. How are you?
Yeah, very good. At some point I have to change up my intro. I think it's always the same.
And do you know what? I always say good and I actually have a cold. It's just like a reflex. I'm like, I'm good. I'm like, actually, I sound horrific, yeah, but
that's
yeah,
all right.
But I feel good.
So Annie and I are here, and we're joined by Dan Holden from Holden Capital. How are you doing, Dan?
Good, mate. Thank you.
Dan's an award-winning broker, and he's got a bit of a niche in the finance space in terms of the sort of commercial and developer side of lending. And he's got a growing business, and he's Brisbane-based. But I won't talk for him. I'll ask him a few questions. First of all, Dan, I want to, I guess, get the growth story of your business in terms of, because you run a very sophisticated operation now where, you know, you're going overseas to secure funding, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But I just wanted to go back in time and ask you how you got into broking and where that, you know, where that growth started to happen to where you are today.
Yeah, sure. So I guess my background isn't actually a banker. I'm a property person. So probably 17 years ago, I started in property development, mm-hmm. working for a property developer. I was there for 5 or 6 years. So putting together property projects and seeing them right through to completion. And integral part of that was financing them. And so through that 5 or 6 years and delivering handful of projects, I got the customs with quite a few different both brokers, funds providers, both domestic and foreign, and just kind of learnt the ropes naturally through that from the developer I worked with. And then about 2007, I think, I actually got approached by a company called Ash Morgan Winthrop, and so they were the largest in Australia. They had 116 staff, offices in all the major cities. They settled about $4 billion a year in debt, and they had a balance sheet of about $300 million, which they would invest into projects. And so that was 2007. So about 10 years ago, I started into the mortgage broking in essence. And then I was there for about 5 years. So it's actually just over, it's 5 years and 2 months ago that I started on my own.
Okay.
I guess that's the start of the growth.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, that's all a relatively short period of time to sort of, you know, amount, you know, to the level of success where you are now. Tell us a little bit about your business as it is today in terms of what, you know, what you're selling, what your volumes are, how many staff you have. Give us a picture of the operation.
Absolutely. So I think last calendar year we did about 340 mil of debt and equity. That was across 84 transactions. So out of that 84, I think we did about 28 or something that were just helping somebody settle the development site portion of the project. So that might be they're buying a piece of dirt for $3 or $4 million, and we'll lend them 50-70% of that value. And then there was about 50, I'll get the math wrong, 56, 58, whatever, actual projects that we funded. And so that's actually lending them the $10, $20, $50 million mm-hmm. to actually build the project itself. So that's, I guess, in terms of the volume size and transactions. Mm. In terms of the team, I think there's 11 people in Brisbane, 10 or 11 in Brisbane. And we've got, we set up an office here in Sydney middle to late last year. And so we've got one guy in Sydney, mm-hmm. and definitely going to grow that in the next couple of months. And Melbourne we've been looking at, and we've interviewed about 5 or 6 people, and we are just waiting to find that right person.
Yep.
An interesting, I guess, way the business has grown is that everybody that's in the business I knew before they joined the team. So we haven't put an ad in paper or hired somebody that we don't actually know before. And it definitely makes, I guess, the trust easier. You know that they're a good person, that they're going to make the right decision, when they're faced with something. And so that's definitely harder to grow the business interstate when you don't actually know that person. So it's a little bit limiting, but so far it's been good, and it makes it for a really good team when you know everybody, at least before they start work, that you can get along with them.
Yeah, it's quite a leap as well going from mortgage broking originally into sort of construction finance and property development, where you're having such big numbers coming through, as you were saying, like 10, 20, 50 million. And
yep.
obviously the projects are going on for a lot longer duration.
Yep.
How did you make that jump? Like, what were the sort of learning curves for you in terms of going from just a standard like tick and flick loan to something complex?
Yeah, to correct that, I didn't start in the actual mortgage broking on its own.
Okay.
I've always just been in construction.
Right.
So when I was in the property development side, I was working in projects that were always in that kind of $10 to $30 million range. And then when I started with Ash Morgan Winthrop, I did exactly the same thing. Yep. So I was working on projects in that kind of $10 to $50 million space. That business was actually more in the structured lending space. So, you know, there's $25 million of senior debt, there's kind of $5 million of junior debt that we invested, and then the developers got kind of $5 million of their own cash in the deal. So yeah, I guess those numbers aren't really that, you know, it's not a big jump because I've always been in that space.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not been a massive kind of change. We do have some of our team are ex-bankers, but they also were in that construction finance space and have been for a long time. So a lot of the guys are pretty specialised in what we do. So we don't do home loans, boat loans, car loans, anything. All we do is just construction loans. Our clients are just elite property developers. They're not kind of, you know, I guess mum and dad investors building a duplex as such. It's more kind of the bigger guys who make a living out of doing property development. Most of them have got, you know, 2 to 20 staff, some have got 50, but the traditional kind of mid-tier private property developer, someone who makes their income out of doing it, not building them and keeping them as an investment or a passive investment strategy.
Yep.
It's that's the target client itself. So most of those guys play in that space with that dollar size. So yeah, but I guess it can be daunting dealing with those bigger numbers sometimes.
Yeah, if you mess up, you really mess up.
Correct. Yeah, you've got to triple check everything. Yeah. And but yeah, after a while, you get a little bit desensitized to the big numbers. It's it just becomes part of the job.
And in terms of your team, sorry, James.
You're right.
In terms of your team, you're saying most of them up in Brisbane. Are most of your clients up that area as well, or are they everywhere?
I'd say probably at the moment, maybe 80%, 75-80%. We've definitely seen a big growth in interstate in the last 2 years since we've started kind of marketing the business.
Right.
The first 3 years we were pretty quiet. I had my existing clients. The guys that I brought on initially started helping me with my existing clients, and then repeat and referral, and that's how the business kind of really grew initially in marketing and new client side of things. And then it was probably maybe 2 years, maybe not quite, that we started to push the marketing pretty hard. Over 2 years ago, that we started pushing the marketing a little bit harder, pushing and driving for interstate deals, both from clients that were based in Brisbane doing projects in Sydney and Melbourne, even Adelaide. We did a few projects up northern Queensland. We've done a couple in Perth recently. It's more repeat referral, word of mouth that has really been the main driver behind our business.
All right, okay.
In terms of the funding side, because this is really interesting, obviously over the last 18 months there's been a general reluctance among the majors, sometimes even, you know, some of the non-majors, they all sort of like, you know, fall together in terms of their pricing and their policy around construction deals and development deals. Also, you know, on the pre-sale side in terms of, you know, lending to mum and dads and people for new properties, that's changed as well. I know we've had a chat over the phone, you know, about where the funding's coming from. Maybe for those, you know, listeners out there who might just be doing resi deals and are sort of interested in the construction side, tell us a little bit about what's happened in terms of your funding mix, in terms of you know where deals are coming from, who's getting the deals in terms of the banks, and also that private funding side as well.
Sure. So I think you hit the nail on the head. It was about 18 months ago. We marketed as November 15 that we saw a massive shift, and it was such a massive shift. It was a pretty rough month for us because we had even approved construction loans of $20-25 million that the bank turned around and said, sorry, we can't do that anymore. So that's not very nice when you go to somebody and say, I know you thought you had 25 million, you've already dug a hole and there's a big crane on the thing, but the bank doesn't want to do it anymore. So that was pretty kind of rough couple of months. It reminded me of the GFC, which I obviously worked through, where you got to deliver bad news and it's not very fun. And like you say, it's big numbers, so people do tend to react differently. And so where the business was, or where the bulk of the business went prior to that, was just across our business, was 64% of our volume was with the major bank. And so we very much built the business around being a major bank broker. So rather than, I guess, traditionally where brokerage in commercial has been, is a little bit of a talk to your bank and then if you have a bit of an issue, come and talk to a broker. That's been the classical, you know, and it is definitely changing, which is great. But that's where brokerage was when I started. And so what we built Holden Capital on was very much around come to us first. We're the experts in our field. We get great results. We've got a good list of clients. You know, it was very much have us part of your project team so that we can help structure the finance correctly from the start, and then we'll manage the bank process for you. So it almost became like project managing the process of the finance rather than the classical brokerage of competing bank to bank and creating that kind of process. So it was slightly different, and so we saw that, I guess, our effort to grow the business as a major bank brokerage be successful by having 2/3 of our volume with the major banks. But then they turned around and not closed the doors, but drastically reduced their appetite. 2015 was interesting because you kind of had the feeling that things were going a little bit, the people having too much fun, and as the saying is, someone took the punch bowl away and the party stopped, which is potentially a good thing long term when you look back at it, that did kind of slow down a little bit. And so since November 15, we've seen a massive increase in non-bank funding. And so non-bank funding is really anything outside of the 6-7 banks that provide capital to property developers. And we've seen that shift in probably two ways. One is that the banks will provide money, but it's at a drastically reduced LVR. So if you're doing a $20 million project, the bank previously would have lent you, say, $16 million, 80% of total development cost. Now they're turning around saying, yeah, we'll lend you 12, and that leaves a massive shortage in capital. And the second, like you say, is pre-sales and just the other terms and conditions that the bank changed pretty drastically. And so I guess in 14-15, we were seeing projects get up with 50% debt cover in the bigger space, as in 15 mil plus. In the sub 15 mil debt space, we were seeing projects get up with less than that, just because it was a good project in a good location with a good sponsor. The bank would say, yeah, look, we're going to take a little bit of a view on this one. And they were so competitive amongst each other that they would fight on terms and conditions to get the deal, which was great for us, providing these fantastic terms that sometimes surprised ourselves. It was like, but the banks were just really competitive and trying to get money out. The two things that we're seeing is the reduction in capital and the increase in terms. And in some cases, it's just the bank just won't provide any money. And we've seen that some suburbs have just been blacklisted by all the banks, where they just go, no, I won't touch that suburb. Even if it's the best deal at a 50% loan to cost ratio with a great guy, I still can't do it. There's policy mechanisms they can't get money out. We have seen a massive influx in non-bank money, and it's interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of that seems to be coming from overseas as well. And this is another thing, which is interesting, is, your traditional broker, mortgage broker, have the aggregator panel of lenders, and they do that. What you're doing is sort of, it's a different type of finance in that you're actually getting on a plane, flying overseas, speaking to, whether it's sovereign wealth funds or high net worth families and things like that, securing funding for your clients back in Australia. Tell us a little bit about how that whole process began and how it's been going.
Yeah, so that's I guess an interesting way to look at it. So we don't use an aggregator. We haven't. I guess we've, like you say, the numbers are a little bit bigger that we meet the criteria to just get direct accreditation with all the lenders. And when I was at Ash Morgan, we didn't use an aggregator either. We dealt direct, and so I didn't really know too much different. So rather than, I guess, relying on that aggregator to discover new lenders and bring them to us and bring that solution and to help us solve deals, it has been, I guess, us fighting and fending for ourselves to find these solutions. But also, I guess, in that corporate space or construction development, in that kind of dollar size, particularly with the high net wealth families, they are very hard to find. There isn't a yellow pages of, billionaires that you can just go and have a chat to.
Unfortunately.
and a lot of it is through word of mouth referral that you can actually get in front of them and then obviously tell them who you are so that when you present a deal that they actually want to look at it, let alone invest in it at one point in time. The hedge fund space is obviously slightly different. It is a little bit less opaque. You can find who's who in the zoo to go and have a chat to, but their appetite for real estate debt in Australia has been very limited post GFC. We are now seeing a little bit of activity, but it's really only on a pretty unique criteria of deals that they're getting involved. Sovereign wealth funds, like you say, we have had discussions with them. Their appetite for Australia is good. Their appetite for small deals is not at all, unless they can get, $1 billion plus out in a single deal or a single bunch of deals, then just not interested. But they don't kind of want to manage it themselves either because they've got so much money and so many things to look at. They don't want to get involved in managing, $20 million deals, they just want to write one big check and expect that money back in 5 years.
Yep.
Whereas construction projects are a lot smaller than that. Most of them are kind of, you know, 20 to 50 million, and they draw up progressively and pay back at once, and it's a lot of management and it's a lot of money in and out. It's very hard for them to manage. Similar to why hedge funds don't have as much appetite for that space. Whereas a small family office, you know, they might be managing one ultra high net worth, or, you know, a dozen kind of mid-tier, you know, still managing a couple hundred million dollars. But for them to kind of, you know, most of them sit on a fair bit of cash anyway, for them to kind of put out $3 million a month for 12 months and then get $40 million back at the end, is they're a little bit more agile that they can do that. But it's actually getting in front of those people. So yeah, it's I guess navigating that and finding that is definitely through a lot of hard work, but also being in the game for a long period of time. And yeah, there's not a Rolodex of who's who in that space, which is an interesting thing. So yeah.
Are there any obstacles to actually bringing the money into the country in terms of sort of like, once you've got these overseas buyers, are there any sort of problems that you're coming across or any changes in the last year?
Yeah, so a lot of them would have existing investments in Australia or have an understanding of how the process works.
Okay.
In the last, I can't remember the exact stats, but I think we've had over 200 meetings and over 200 flights or whatever we've done in the last kind of 18 months to help find this capital. We have had a lot of meetings. A lot of them, some of them have been with people that aren't already in Australia, and so we had to kind of do that whole story around why is Australia good. And but a lot of them, if they've invested in Australia, they do understand that process, and we haven't really had to do much hand holding in that kind of currency forex type space. Yeah. Or with the FIRB type stuff. Mm. As well, I don't think FIRB applies because they're just investing in a mortgage scheme, not buying an actual real estate asset. So yeah, luckily we haven't had to deal with a lot of that firsthand. It's been dealing with people who already understand it.
Did you have to sort of upskill, or, you know, was there any mentors during this process in terms of, you know, you're dealing with sophisticated investors, and you're presenting, you're selling yourself, you're selling the country, I guess, you know, sometimes, like you said. Mm. You know, and the opportunity in Australia. Was there any training, or was it just learning on the job?
I guess when I was at Ash Morgan, there was still a little bit of involvement in, you know, obviously we had our lender list that we could pitch deals to, but there was very often a case where you'd have to go outside of that and, yep, and find other, for example, you know, if you're looking to put debt or equity, subordinated debt or subordinate equity into a deal, into another project, a very good kind of match to find that capital, if you need $5 million for a deal to get the project happening, where, like I was saying before, if you got 20 mil of bank debt, 5 mil subordinated, 5 mil from the developer. A very good source of capital is actually another developer who's sitting on a bit of coin, and because they already understand the process, they understand the risk, they understand the reward. And so it's a little bit of a, not low-hanging fruit, but just to go and have a chat to another developer. So kind of being nimble and going out and finding your own kind of pockets of capital was something that's always been, you know, a little bit of a part of the job. In terms of the overseas side of it, definitely it was initially quite interesting, and, you know, sitting down with some guys who are, you know, worth tens of billions of dollars and, yeah, having a coffee with them in a Starbucks, it's a pretty interesting experience. Nerve-wracking for sure. Mm. Particularly when, you know, you've kind of got a couple of minutes to impress them, or I'm sure they've got other things to do with their time and money. So yeah, definitely that was an interesting process for me. And particularly when you're on those kind of junkets or roadshows, you're doing, you know, 6 to 8 meetings a day, and you've got to do the same pitch. Mm. Time and time again, and it's got to be on point, and you've got to kind of navigate it a little bit to them, depending on, you know, if they own property in Australia already, or if they're investing in Australia already, how much they understand about real estate debt, how much they understand about subordinated debt structures, all that kind of stuff. You've got to be a little bit nimble in your pitch, and do it multiple times a day, generally for 10 days or whatever in a row, to make it worthwhile. So there was a big learning curve there in terms of that side of it, but it was fun. It was exciting, and yeah, many goosebumps and sweaty palms talking to some of those big shots, that's for sure.
It is exciting, and it's very different to, you know, the typical mortgage broker experience that we, you know, sort of.
And how did you prepare for that? I mean, you were saying there was sort of obviously just a lot of trial and error, but did you like test it out on your colleagues, or did you kind of go and like talk to anyone else?
An elevator pitch?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that we did, but it was definitely nerve-wracking. I probably should have, and then I'd have been so nervous. But it was just interesting. And then what I did find interesting about it is that once they understand your story and I guess the opportunity that's created here with the tightening of debt, that it makes it interesting for them, that they then do get interested and they go, yes, this makes sense. Mm. And then, you know, the final question is always like anyone else that we should be talking to. And quite a few of them, you know, get out their phone and say, yeah, you should be talking to Bob and Jim and Frank and these guys. They also have, you know, bucket loads of money and they like Australia and yeah. and they'd be worth talking to. So it is interesting once you kind of get the momentum going that it does.
You get a referral network just like
yeah.
anywhere else.
Correct, yeah. But you got to ask the question. Of course. So, but yeah, it's been a really good process, I guess, for the last 12, 18 months that we've been pounding the pavement and facilitating that investment, yeah. which is good.
Which of the Asian countries, whether it's Singapore or, you know, Hong Kong or mainland China or what have you, what have been the most successful in terms of their appetite for Australian debt?
Yeah, sure. So obviously Singapore and Hong Kong are the main because they've got a lot of Aussies working over there, a lot mm. of expats that understand the space. A lot of people understand the banking system. It's very easy to communicate. And a lot of the, I guess, the wealth managers, the family office managers are, you know, either Poms or Yanks or Aussies mm. that have a pretty good understanding. So you're not trying to explain the whole story to them.
Of course,
you yeah. can quickly narrow down into actually what the requirements are. But we have done some varied trips. So we've been to the States, we've been to Japan, we've been to obviously Sydney, Melbourne regularly talking to high net worth guys there. We're about to do New Zealand. It's got a pretty decent collection of old school generational money. So yeah, it's just getting out there and understanding who's got an appetite for it.
And how do you sell the sort of the projects? I mean, assuming that these clients are not just funding one project, they're going to have money in like things in lots of different pies.
Yep.
Is there something in particular they're looking to get on board with in your pitch that, you know, you're sort of doing in Starbucks? Is there something mm, yep. they're like, I love that, I want to do this particularly mm. that they're really drawn to?
Yeah, I'd say probably the best phrase or way to capture that is that we've been saying you're doing bank replacement debt that the banks would have done 12 months ago, but you're getting double-digit returns for it.
Yep.
And so people hear that as lower risk yeah, and higher safe. Return.
Yeah. Of course,
and yeah. that's probably what is the main motivator for them to go, oh, this sounds interesting. Okay, yeah. like to get involved in that. And also just the check size as well is a big barrier for quite a few people. You know, trying to facilitate an investment of only $5 million, it just doesn't make sense for them. A lot of them have benchmarks that they'll only do a deal at a minimum of $30 million. And there's kind of no maximum, which is scary. But, you know, for them, it's just not worth them mobilising a group of people to understand a particular project if they're not going to get, an 18-month, 12%, 15% per annum return
yeah.
on $30 million makes it worthwhile them spending their time and understanding that, doing that risk analysis themselves.
Yeah. Okay.
It's interesting to hear you talk about this because, you know, from our point of view as journalists and people, you know, covering this space all the time, you know, we obviously see the regulatory change happen. We see the bank appetite, you know, change, their pricing policy announcements, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you've now got the opportunities that the gaps in the market are creating, and you're obviously, you know, filling one yourself. I mean, did you, as soon as the bank started pulling back, did you see that there was an opportunity there, or were you literally just, you were looking for a solution? I mean,
I think it was, like you say, once the bank started retreating, pre-GFC, we had a really healthy non-bank market mm. of construction lenders. Unfortunately, a lot of them got decimated in the GFC because they had a business model in a pooled mortgage fund. Borrow short, lend long is the way, but I'll explain that so that it can be talked about. So borrowing short is you're raising money. It might only be 100 grand chunks from retirees or, you know, those kind of retail investors, and they've got the ability to withdraw their money with a couple of days notice. And so you're borrowing short and then you're lending long. So you're lending on a fixed term 12 to 18 month construction loan to a developer, and the first month's draw you can't get back until you get the whole loan back on completion
yeah.
from repayment via pre-sales or on completion sales. So borrowing short, lending long was the, I guess, the business model in the mortgage fund manager world that really, as soon as the market kind of tanked, it fell off a cliff overnight because they didn't have the ability to cover their redemptions, and all of a sudden they didn't have enough to continue funding the projects that they had already committed to. So that's how that non-bank market really just got sucked up into a vacuum of it didn't exist overnight, which was unfortunate because pre-GFC and some of the projects that I did as a development manager on the property development side and some of the projects I funded as a mortgage broker on the debt side were really good projects funded by, you know, good non-bank lenders. And then, you know, come 2009, most of them are gone, and it then really became a bank-centric property development landscape. You had to do, you know, developers had to be doing feasibilities based on the bank's criteria. They could obviously look at shortfall pieces, you know, subordinated debt or equity joint ventures, but it became, you know, a field day for the banks to go out there and really dominate the market. And I'd say, you know, 9, 10, 11, almost through to, you know, November 2015 was just a heavily bank-driven real estate debt market, which is an interesting space. So seeing it now kind of evolve back into what it is, where it's not starting from scratch, definitely, but it's just those investors who were involved in that previously getting comfortable again to do that. And we have seen a few not come back to life, but definitely, you know, if they post GFC, if they're only managing, say, 70 million or 100 million and doing just, you know, 15 deals a year, they've kind of increased now to 200, 300 million. They're doing a little bit more as the investors get more comfortable. We're in a low interest rate environment, so getting a couple of percent in the bank's boring. They put it with these mortgage money managers, fund managers, and they're getting 8.5%, 9%.
Yeah.
Now it's actually creating an investment proposition for them that's worthwhile to take that risk again. And they're seeing a buoyant real estate market. They're seeing cranes in the sky. They're seeing, you know, there's no catastrophes of pre-sales not settling yet. There's all these good things. So those retail investors coming back into the space is definitely helping. The wholesale investors coming back into the space, I guess, is more where I focus on. And we are seeing more comfort from those capital providers. But they've just got this traditional mindset that they want double digit returns and they want to get big chunks of capital out in a single transaction. So, you know, trying to provide a mortgage solution for real estate developers in that kind of middle market is a little bit more challenging. So to explain that better, if you're looking for a construction loan of 5 mil and below, there's probably 30 to 40 lenders that we can broker that transaction to. Once you go above 5 mil, it drops off pretty quickly. And then once you go above 10 mil, it drops off even further. And then it's pretty slim pickings until you get to probably about that 30 mil space where you can then start attracting some of the bigger corporate investors at a, you know, probably a 12%, you know, type return, which is obviously substantially different to borrowing from the bank at 5%. Yeah. So even that in itself, trying to get a developer comfortable to pay more for their money, that's an experience also.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you one final question, and that was about the oversupply undersupply argument, because I mean, it's not in the papers as much as it was, you know, like late last year, but there was a sort of fear, and I know, you know, CoreLogic does its sort of settlement risk report, you know, so it's been enough for them to, you know, come out with their own reporting on it. But, you know, Brisbane apartment market, Melbourne certain pockets, not too much Sydney, but you know, that's been the sort of rhetoric, is there's a potential oversupply on the cards, things won't settle in a few years time, all the sort of stuff. How much truth is there in that, and how is it playing out for your business and also for the conversations you're having with developers and also funders for that matter?
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's kind of hard for when you put yourself in a developer's shoes and you look at that question and try and answer it. As a developer, you're generally working on a project for 6, 12, 18 months before you actually take it to market, in terms of identifying the site, negotiating the purchase, you know, amending or getting an approval from council to build it, locking in your GRs, your construction prices, and actually getting it to work. And so by the time you see the hoarding go up and the sales office go up, that developer's been pregnant with that project for quite some time. So, you know, definitely, like you say, before Christmas last year, there was a lot of talk about oversupply and the world's going to stop turning and doom, yep. doom. And then we come back this year and it definitely kind of disappeared pretty quickly, which is great. To answer it from a developer's point of view, just because in September, October, November, the Fin Review published every day that the world's going to stop, doesn't mean that they can, you know, be half pregnant with a project and that's go, right. Oh, well, I'm going to just wait until the Fin Review stops panicking till I keep doing my big project. So it's very hard for them. It's a long gestation period. In terms of lenders, there's definitely a lot more reactionary kind of, you know, week to week, month to month, how they feel about the market and particular pockets of the market. Like I say, the major banks sometimes have a bit of a blanket approach to certain suburbs or you know, geographical places where they go, look, either we've got too much money out in that pocket, therefore we can't do that deal, or we just think that suburb's got a bit of an oversupply, a bit of a smell about it for the time being. You know, we'll readdress it later. But so it's definitely more short-term adjustments of view for a lender, but it's hard for a developer to kind of change so quickly. In answer to just the timing of that, like you say, late last year there was a lot of talk about oversupply. You know, we experienced a lot of lenders really retracting pretty quickly and saying, no, look, we're going to wait and see what happens. An interesting thing that we had before Christmas, we issued a lot of approvals for large tranche residual stock loans. So that might be they've built 150 apartments, they've sold 110, and we get a finance approval to refinance maybe 60 or 70 of them, mm-hmm. because developers were being prepared and saying, well, if I've got 110 of 150 under contract, let's assume there's a fallover rate of worst case 20 or 30%. So therefore, I need to be in a position to refinance the existing construction loan and the unsold product. And we settled quite a few of them. We did about four or five of them that were anywhere from 20 to 40 apartments in a single tranche. But there was a big run-up just to Christmas, before Christmas, where we issued a bunch of approvals for bigger tickets like $20, $30 million residual stock loans. None of them have yet settled because the pre-sales that have come in have settled better than expected and the sales rate has actually increased. So I guess that's my little anecdote firsthand that I've seen in our business is we were ready to settle some pretty big ticket residual stock loans there, and those five anyway, just before Christmas, not one of them's yet settled. Three of them have formally been withdrawn, and the other two, I'm pretty sure they're going to find that the sales are there and they don't need it, which is good.
The market's still strong, basically.
I'm seeing that the September, October, November kind of doom and gloom in the press was probably a little bit of a knee-jerk, and thankfully a lot of those settlements that were concerned about when the cranes were in the sky, and now that there's actually settlements happening, that there's a lot more comfort in both the developers and the lender space. You know, I've seen some developers that were looking at parking projects and now going, look, we think it's all right. And definitely I've seen lenders, because they can change their mind a lot quicker than a developer, more comfortable to get back in the market and get some money out the door, which is great.
Before we close, Daniel, I just wanted to ask, I mean, obviously a lot of our listeners are mortgage brokers. They might not be in the commercial space, but I know that in the last year or so, lots of people have been looking at diversifying. Would you recommend that people break into this space? And if so, what are your tips for trying to start doing this? Because it sounds like you need...
Do you welcome competition?
Okay, tricky question, righto. Look, I think it's definitely exciting. Definitely, you know, like you say, the numbers probably look bigger and not scarier, but you know, more intimidating to get involved in.
And attractive, though, in that way.
It is, in a sense. So I'd probably say just tread carefully, because the numbers are bigger. If you make a mistake, then it has pretty big repercussions. You know, if you get somebody a home loan of, I don't know, 450 grand instead of 480,000, they're probably going to be pretty pissed off, and you know, 3 days later they'll probably find the extra 30 grand and it'll still go ahead. You know, if you go to somebody and say, mate, I've, you know, that approval for 16 million is now 12 million, it and they're already pregnant with the project, it's shovel ready, or they've already dug a hole.
It's
just a little bit more impact because of the bigger numbers. And so for that kind of point, I'd just say that it's something that, you know, maybe progressively step up into that space, under, you know, do some duplex splitter blocks type stuff, understand the terminology, understand there is a lot more variables to a construction loan than a home loan or an investment loan, and so there's a lot more things to negotiate, and when you don't have the knowledge to negotiate them, sometimes it can end up impacting the developer quite substantially. It's not just about LVR, cost of funds. There's a lot more things. There's probably at least 10 more than just those two drivers that actually make the deal good or bad. So I'd say just, I wouldn't say don't do it because that sounds silly. I'd say just definitely baby steps and progress up to a point where you're involved in it. And, you know, even working for a bigger firm who's already in that space for 6 to 12 months to kind of cut your teeth and make some mistakes and then kind of go into it rather than just quitting your day job and going and having a crack, I'd say just be careful.
Yeah.
You know, you start making mistakes with other people's money, particularly when it's millions of dollars, there's definitely repercussions. So, I wouldn't say run out and do it tomorrow. I'd say just, you know, ease into it. It is fun, it is enjoyable, but there's definitely mistakes can be made quickly.
Yeah. Good stuff and sound words of advice there. Well, I think that's all the time we got. So thanks very much for joining us, Dan.
No worries, guys. Thanks very much.
And thanks, Annie, once again. That was Dan Holden from Holden Capital. And I've been your host, James Mitchell. And join us next week for another episode of Elite Broker. Catch you then.